Section 2, Slavery Binds and Divides. As you read, look for how the invention of the cotton gin led to an increased demand for slaves in the South, growing support in the North for abolition, two compromises that delayed the breakup of the Union, a nullification crisis in South Carolina and a popular sovereignty fight in Kansas, and the following terms: abolition, Underground Railroad, Missouri Compromise, protective tariff, nullification, secede, free soil, Compromise of 1850, and Kansas-Nebraska Act. An essential part of the representative democracy of the United States is negotiation and compromise. Senators and representatives know that they will not always get everything they want when a law is being written or a budget considered. The Founding Fathers understood that elected officials would need to have ongoing discussions to reach agreements. Elected leaders would also have to understand that they would not always have their way. Instead, they would be challenged to find ways to settle disputes by giving up some parts of what they wanted in order to reach an agreement. This process is called compromise. One issue requiring negotiation and compromise was slavery. The institution of slavery bound its victims, but the issue divided the free people in the country. An increasing number of Americans saw slavery as incompatible with the values of a free, democratic society. The country was growing larger, but with those great distances came differences. People began to have their own concerns that were different from those of other Americans. Differences in thinking in different areas of the nation created a feeling of sectionalism. People in a given region came to believe that their ideas and interests were better or more important than those of another area or region. As the country expanded westward, it meant the question of slavery had to be answered. Both Congress and the courts tried. Negotiation and compromise were demanded of national and state leaders as opposition to slavery grew. Anti-slavery campaigns had as their goal the elimination of slavery. Southerners whose wealth was tied to slavery could not imagine life without it. Also, if the slaves were freed, would they have voting rights? The loss of wealth and power was seen as a threat to many people in the South. There appeared to be little room for compromise, though some found it for a while. The cotton gin and the expansion of slavery. Slavery was on the decline in the late 1700s. States from Pennsylvania northward, where farms were generally smaller, abolished slavery early on. It was in the South, where large fields of crops might be grown, that slave labor had attraction. By 1800, the economy of the South was stagnant, not growing, in terms of population growth and agriculture. Tobacco production had depleted, used up, the soil in Virginia and North Carolina. Rice could only be grown in Louisiana and along the coast in South Carolina and Georgia. Sea Island cotton could be grown profitably, but it required a climate and soil that only existed along the southeastern coast. Before 1790, growing cotton on a large scale was not practical. The cotton used for clothing grows inside a pod or bowl on a bush. The seeds inside the cotton bowl had to be picked out by hand before the cotton could be spun into threads. Eli Whitney is given credit for figuring out a way to speed the process of removing seeds from ripe cotton bolls. He was visiting a plantation near Savannah, Georgia, when he learned of the challenge. He set about creating a machine, or cotton engine, shortened to gin, to do the work, which he patented in 1794. His successful cotton gin transformed cotton production in the South. Before the cotton gin, one man could clean seeds from only about 1 pound of cotton per day. With Whitney's invention, a man could clean 50 pounds of cotton per day. Effects of Whitney's invention were profound. Southerners realized that much of the land in the region's interior could grow cotton as a cash crop that would create great profit. Labor was needed to plant and maintain the fields, and slaves were the chosen source of labor. At the same time cotton production was becoming practical, factories in Great Britain were becoming more efficient. New machines meant that workers could produce textile goods more quickly. if the factories were producing more, they would need more cotton. Whitney's invention was there to help. Removal of the Native Americans from southern states opened even more land for cotton production. There were no machines to do the work of planting, weeding, and picking the cotton, so vast numbers of enslaved people were needed to keep the cotton-based economy running. By 1860, the Lower South had earned the nickname Cotton Kingdom. Cotton accounted for about 50% of the exports from the United States, and most of the world's supply of cotton came from the region. In North Carolina, cotton was grown extensively on the coastal plain and in counties along the South Carolina border. The area along the border between Mecklenburg and Cabarrus counties, where the Charlotte Motor Speedway and Concord Mills Mall are located today, was called one of the finest districts for upland cotton in the whole South. Growing differences on the question of slavery. In northern states where cotton was not raised, many people were opposed to slavery. These sentiments were particularly strong among the descendants of the Puritans, who were the first settlers to New England. Puritanism had emphasized the idea that, if there was something sinful going on, the whole community, and by definition the nation, could be punished. One result of this religious idea was an increased support for abolition, the movement to do away with slavery, when so many Southerners migrated west and took slaves with them. Many Northern whites, a few Southern whites, and free blacks worked to get rid of slavery. These abolitionists made speeches, wrote books and articles, and offered their homes as safe houses for runaway slaves. In 1831, the abolition movement found a voice and great organizer when William Lloyd Garrison founded his newspaper, The Liberator. Printed in Boston, the paper was dedicated to exposing the horrors of slavery and calling for it to end. Garrison hoped to persuade people that slavery was morally wrong. Within 2 years, he and others had founded the American Anti-Slavery Society. While most Northerners initially opposed these efforts and simply wanted to leave the issue to the South, the movement grew stronger and stronger over the next years. Early efforts mainly involved what was called moral persuasion. Some abolitionists also participated in the informal system of routes and safe houses that helped slaves, mainly from the border states, escape to the North. In 1831, this became known as the Underground Railroad. By 1840, abolitionism was becoming a political issue, and anti-slavery Northerners founded the Liberty Party in 1840. The work of other abolitionists increased calls for an end to slavery. Sojourner Truth, a former slave, became a prominent abolitionist but also an advocate for women's rights. Her famous speech to the Ohio Women's Rights Convention in 1851 excited listeners. Among her views was the idea that women, white and black, should have the same voting rights as men. Other abolitionists, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the Grimke sisters, Sarah Moore and Angelina Emily, expanded civil rights work to include rights for women as well as slaves. Southern slave owners and some other white Southerners felt threatened by the anti-slavery movement. They saw slaves as necessary to their economic system. As Northerners attacked the system, white Southerners became more defensive of it. They argued that African Americans were racially inferior and were better off in slavery. They even said that slavery had good points because slaves were taken care of and were taught Christianity. For the next 20 years, Northern attacks on the morality of slavery increased Southern attempts to protect it. As the United States grew economically in the 1800s, different sections of the country continued to develop in different ways. In Upper South states, such as Virginia and Kentucky, tobacco was still a major crop. After Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin, the Lower South states from South Carolina all the way across to eastern Texas had become cotton producers. Rice was still grown in Louisiana, coastal Georgia, and the Carolinas. Louisiana also produced some sugar from sugarcane. All of these cash crops required many workers, so slavery grew in all those areas. Farming was also important in states of the upper Midwest, where the major crops were grains such as wheat. The invention in the 1830s of a better plow by John Deere and of a machine to reap, harvest, wheat by Cyrus McCormick made it possible for the average farmer to grow much more wheat without extra workers. So even though both the South and this western area of the North based their economies on farming, northern farmers did not use slaves. Another difference between the sections of the country was that the North had begun to industrialize more than the South. By the 1800s, New Englanders were taking advantage of swift-flowing rivers to power industry. They built factories that manufactured various goods, including guns, shoes, and most importantly, cloth. The textile mills of the New England states used cotton grown in the southern states to manufacture cloth. The concentration of factories along the mid-Atlantic coast led to the growth of towns and cities, so the Northeast became increasingly urban, city-centered, while the South stayed mainly rural, farm-centered. These sectional differences led to differences in the kinds of laws the areas were willing to support. From the 1820s to the end of America's war with Mexico in 1848, many events increased sectionalism in the United States. Special feature, Carolina people, North Carolinians, and the Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad is one of the most inspiring stories in American history. To escape from slavery required courage and endurance on the part of African Americans. To help slaves find their way to freedom required whites to risk their property, reputation, and sometimes even their own freedom. A few North Carolinians were important in these efforts. Quakers on the northern edge of the Uwharrie Mountains decided slavery was wrong and followed their consciences by participating in efforts to free slaves. They helped create and sustain the Underground Road, the name for the Underground Railroad before railroads were invented in the 1830s. After the American Revolution, Quakers across America began to live up to the ideal of liberty and freedom and chose to stop owning slaves. North Carolina Quakers were no different. By 1809, they had begun to sell their slaves to their yearly meeting, their church organization, and it began to manumit, release from slavery, them to Haiti, Liberia, and the Northwest Territory, where slavery was forbidden. After the War of 1812, many of the same Quakers decided to move to the Northwest to get away from the slave system, and they established some of the first stations along the road where escapees could come to hide and be helped. Chief among these activists were members of the Coffin family, who belonged to the New Garden meeting near Guilford Courthouse. They were noted for preaching what they believed and practicing what they preached. Elizabeth Coffin even spoke out in the meeting house. She may have been the first female North Carolinian ever to preach in a church. Elisha, Levi, and Vestal Coffin had begun to help runaway slaves in the early 1800s. They accompanied black men along the Kanawha Road, which went through what is today West Virginia, and stayed with them until they had crossed the Ohio River. More than once, they had to hide from the human bloodhounds, their term for slave catchers, who were chasing them. Levi Coffin became the best known of the anti-slave activists. Levi often told people how he first saw his first coffle, people chained together, of slaves at the age of 7. They had been separated from their families in Virginia and were being taken away from their families to Alabama to grow cotton. While he was a teen, he watched in horror as a slave with a rope around his neck was forced to run behind the wagon of his master with the horses at full gallop. The teenager became so bold in his opposition to slavery that he even convinced his neighbor, Dr. David Caldwell, founder of the famous Log College, not to punish a runaway. In 1824, Coffin married Catherine White, and in 1826, they moved to Indiana. The Coffins opened a store at Newport, near the Ohio line. Dozens of Uwharrie families, both white and black, had settled in the area, and already they were helping slaves escape to Canada, where they would be safe. The Coffins devoted the rest of their lives to the cause. They spent most of the profits from their store on supplies, clothing, and medicine for the escapees. They went to bed every night knowing that a gentle rap on the door meant they had company to keep. often parties of 10 to 15 at a time, were in their house. If slave catchers pounded on the door to be let in, they never seemed to get the idea of gentle rapping. Coffin demanded they go 20 miles away and get a proper search warrant. Meanwhile, the slaves would leave. The coffins used false bottoms in their wagons to hide slaves as they took them to the next station north. When they built a new house, they had hiding places built into the walls of some of the rooms. Over the course of 20 years, they helped more than 2,000 people escape slavery. They never asked anyone his or her name to avoid being forced to identify any person who was arrested and brought to court. In 1847, the Coffins moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, where they ran a free labor store which sold nothing that had been made by slaves. Over time, Levi became known as the president of the Underground Railroad, so central was he to the effort. Some of his experiences were put into the famous novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, a book that Abraham Lincoln said helped cause the Civil War. In 1863, after the Emancipation Proclamation took effect, Coffin and other leading abolitionists were honored at a ceremony at Plymouth Rock in Massachusetts, the place where the Pilgrims had started the pursuit of American freedom back in 1620. Section 2 continued. The Missouri Compromise. As anti-slavery sentiment increased, Southerners wanted to ensure that Congress could not pass laws to abolish slavery. One way to do that was to make sure that there were equal numbers of free and slaveholding states. By this method, a balance could be kept in the U.S. Senate that would ensure that no law to abolish slavery could be passed. Missouri was part of the Louisiana Purchase Territory, and no laws had been passed about whether slavery would be allowed in states made from the territory. In fact, when Louisiana became a state in 1812, it allowed slavery. In 1819, Missouri requested statehood. At that time, there were 11 slave states, those that allowed slavery, and 11 free states, those that no longer allowed slavery or were in the process of abolishing it. This meant that the U.S. Senate had an equal number of senators from slave states and from free states. In the U.S. House of Representatives, the free states had more members because they had a greater population than the slave states. Missouri planned to allow slavery. This would upset the balance in the Senate in favor of slave states. A congressman from the free state of Illinois, which was next to Missouri, wanted to change the Missouri statehood law to require Missouri to do away with slavery. This caused a huge debate. Southern states were outraged, while northern states supported the idea. Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise. Missouri would be allowed to join the Union as a slave state. Maine, which was part of Massachusetts at that time, would be divided from Massachusetts and admitted as a free state. This plan would maintain the balance between slave and free states in the U.S. Senate. To prevent further arguments, a line was drawn westward across the rest of the Louisiana Purchase Territory, even with Missouri's southern border, 36 degrees 30 minutes north latitude. North of the line would be free territory. Slavery would be allowed south of the line. Even though that meant there was more free territory, most of it was thinly populated plains. That dry land was not good for crops and not attractive to settlers. Although both sides accepted this Missouri Compromise in 1820, the event showed that the question of slavery and its expansion into new areas was going to be an issue that divided the people. History by the Highway, Thomas Hart Benton. Thomas Hart Benton was born at Hart's Mill, just to the west of Hillsboro, moved to Tennessee as a young adult. He was an aide to General Andrew Jackson in the War of 1812. Benton later moved to Missouri and became its United States Senator when Missouri became a state. He served in the Senate longer than any American before the Civil War. Benton was a loyal Jacksonian, a believer in manifest destiny, and a supporter of tight money, the idea that most trade should be conducted in coin instead of paper money. Later in his life, he became a critic of the idea of slavery, which angered many Southerners. Section 2 continued. The Nullification Crisis. The first protective tariff was passed by Congress in 1816. The tariff added a tax to manufactured goods imported from other countries. The idea was that this would encourage Americans to buy goods made in the United States, which did not have the tax and were therefore less expensive. The tariff had wide support from the public, who wanted to encourage the establishment of manufacturing in America. The 1816 tariff had passed without Southern support. Southerners thought it would be temporary, lasting until American manufacturers had become successful enough to compete without it. When an even higher tariff passed Congress in 1828, however, many in the South objected. With little manufacturing in their area, Southerners increasingly saw the protective tariff as a tax that helped Northerners. Vice President John C. Calhoun, who had supported the 1816 tariff, secretly wrote a pamphlet against the 1828 tariff. Calhoun, a South Carolinian, argued that a state had the right to void a law that it thought unconstitutional. This idea of voiding and not following national laws within a state is known as nullification. The concept of nullification became part of the states' rights argument, the belief that all powers not specifically given to the national government in the U.S. Constitution or specifically denied to the states should remain with the states. Calhoun thought a state had a right to put itself between the national government and the people. A law could be nullified only in a special state convention called for that purpose, not by the state legislature. By Calhoun's thinking, the law would remain void, not valid or legally binding, unless the national government passed a constitutional amendment giving it the specific power to make such a law. If the state was still opposed, he argued that the state had the right to secede or withdraw from the United States. In 1829, John C. Calhoun, who had served as vice president under President John Quincy Adams, was reelected vice president in President Andrew Jackson's administration. When another tariff was passed in 1832, an angry Calhoun resigned and went home to South Carolina to fight the tariff. He considered that a tax of over 60% was too high. Southerners were especially concerned because, if the British sold fewer goods to the United States, they would have less money to pay for cotton. The South Carolina legislature called a convention that nullified the tariff. South Carolina planned to refuse to collect the taxes on goods coming into its port of Charleston. As president, Andrew Jackson had to enforce the national law, so he prepared to do that even if it meant having to use federal troops. South Carolina threatened to secede if troops were used. This was a real crisis, and other southern states discussed what to do. South Carolina hoped that other states might also nullify the tariff. North Carolina did not. Most state leaders were highly critical of South Carolina's actions. They worried that they might be pulled into war defending themselves. In 1833, Henry Clay offered another compromise, and South Carolina agreed to follow the national law. The plan was for the tariff to be gradually lowered to about 20% over the next 10 years. This entire incident is known as the nullification crisis. This stance for states' rights in South Carolina had an even deeper issue than the tariff, the question of slavery. Slaves made up over 50% of that state's population, and South Carolina's political leaders did not want the national government to have the power to pass a law that would limit or abolish slavery. Great Britain was planning to pass a law ending slavery in all its territories. It passed in 1833. South Carolinians were afraid that Congress might do the same in the United States. The slavery problem worsens. By the late 1840s, the anti-slavery movement in the North had become stronger. Even Northerners who believed that slavery could not be interfered with where it already existed also believed that the national government had the right to keep it from spreading into new territories. This idea was known as free soil. In the election of 1848, the anti-slavery Liberty Party supporters joined with free soil supporters to form the Free Soil Party. The Democratic Party responded by defining the Democratic ideal of popular sovereignty to suit their cause. They thought that people in a new territory should be allowed to decide an issue, such as whether to allow slavery, for themselves. From the election of 1848 until the Civil War broke out, slavery and the question of its expansion continued to be a major political issue. The Compromise of 1850. California voters had approved a state constitution by November 1849 and requested statehood as a free state. Southern slave owners immediately opposed that, even though Californians had used popular sovereignty, deciding for themselves that they did not want slavery. California's admission as a free state would change the balance of power between free and slave states in the Senate. Debates over the issue, which lasted for 8 months, were heated. Some Southerners predicted that if a balance of power was not guaranteed, a war between North and South would come. The two major national political parties at the time, the Democrats and the Whigs, found themselves being torn apart on sectional lines. Leaders trying to hold their parties and the country together tried to find another compromise. In the end, five laws passed Congress in a deal known as the Compromise of 1850. Supporters in the North and South saw this compromise as saving the country from breaking up. They hoped it would settle things as the Missouri Compromise had done. The compromise was accepted, even though many in the North and South did not like it. In the North, the sight of runaway slaves, including some who had been in the North for a long time, being captured and taken away in shackles, bands placed around wrists or ankles and connected by a chain, led many Northerners to resist the fugitive slave law. Some began to help slaves escape from those who had captured them. In reaction to the compromise, Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, a novel that showed the horrors of slavery through the story of the slaves Uncle Tom, Eliza, and Eliza's young child. When the book was published in 1852, it sold 300,000 copies and stirred Northerners' anti-slavery feelings. Meanwhile, leaders in the South resented these attacks on slavery and became even more suspicious of the North. The Kansas-Nebraska Act. Back in 1820, Southerners had supported the Missouri Compromise, which allowed slavery in the Louisiana Purchase Territory south of Missouri's southern border. Since that time, Iowa had come into the Union as the only free state from the Louisiana Purchase Territory, even though the area north of the Missouri Compromise line was mainly plains, some Northerners wanted it open for settlement. Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas wanted to run a transcontinental railroad through the area with its eastern end in Chicago. In 1854, Douglas introduced legislation to organize this area into new territories, Kansas and Nebraska. To get Southern support, he included a clause stating that the Compromise of 1850 had made popular sovereignty available to the territories. This changed the prohibition of slavery set out in the Missouri Compromise. Because Kansas was next door to Missouri, it might possibly become a slave state, although Douglas personally believed that the land was not good for plantations and Kansas would probably become a free state. When the Kansas-Nebraska Act passed, many northern free soilers believed that the national government had come under the control of some sort of slave power. Every northern Whig congressman had voted against it, as had every northern Whig in the Senate. The Kansas-Nebraska Act killed the Whig Party in the country. Northern Whigs did not want to be in the same party with southern Whigs. In the elections in the fall of 1854, old northern Whigs ran under various names. In the end, they and free soilers joined to form a new party, the Republican Party. The new party believed that the national government had the right to limit slavery to those areas where it already existed and to ban it in new territories. Kansas was the ground on which the increasing differences between the North and South became violent. Those who lived there were to decide if it would become a slave state or a free state. Thousands of settlers moved into Kansas so they could vote. Anti-slavery supporters in New England raised money to send anti-slavery voters to Kansas. Pro-slavery Missourians, some of whom never actually lived in Kansas, crossed into Kansas to vote to support slavery. The result was a territorial legislature that had more pro-slavery members. It voted to allow slavery. anti-slavery voters complained about voting fraud. By January 1856, two governments were set up in Kansas, one pro-slavery and the other anti-slavery. Each claimed to be the true government. By the summer of 1856, the dispute had gone beyond the legislature into the countryside. Pro-slavery supporters attacked the free soil town of Lawrence, burning down buildings and looting. After hearing about Lawrence, white abolitionist John Brown and his followers vowed revenge. They murdered five pro-slavery Kansans who were unarmed. Pro-slavery Kansans retaliated, and Kansas soon became Bleeding Kansas. The Republicans in 1856 ran on the free soil platform of not allowing slavery to expand into new territory, while the Democrats supported popular sovereignty. For its first national election, the Republicans made a good showing, but Democrat James Buchanan won the presidency. The Dred Scott Case. 2 days after President Buchanan was sworn in, the U.S. Supreme Court tried to end the arguments over slavery through a decision in the case of Dred Scott and his family. Although he had been a slave his entire life, Dred Scott had traveled and lived with his owner, an army doctor, in Illinois, a free state, and Wisconsin, a free territory. His daughter had been born in Wisconsin. In 1846, Scott had begun the court suit for his and his family's freedom because they had lived in territory that did not allow slavery. 10 years later, in 1857, the case reached the Supreme Court. The court ruled that blacks, free or slave, were not citizens, which meant they did not have the right to sue. The court went on to argue that slaves were property. Being in free territory did not change that. In other words, slaves could be taken to free territories by their owners and would remain slaves. Finally, the court ruled that Congress had never had the right to forbid slavery in the territories. It was a victory for the Southern position, but angry Northerners were not ready to give up. John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry. One Northerner who had not given up was John Brown of Bleeding Kansas. Brown had the idea that Southern slaves needed help to liberate themselves. He came up with the idea of raiding the U.S. government's arsenal, arms storehouse, at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, now West Virginia. He planned to take guns and ammunition, arm the slaves, and start a slave revolt. 8 of his men, including 2 sons, were killed, and Brown himself was captured. 2 of the raiders were free people of color from North Carolina, Lewis Leary of Fayetteville, and John A. Copeland, Jr. of Raleigh. Leary died in the fight. Brown was quickly convicted of murder, treason, and trying to start a rebellion. He was hanged, as was Copeland. Although many Northerners opposed Brown's violence, some anti-slavery Northerners saw him as a martyr, a person killed because of their beliefs. In the South, Brown's raid alarmed white Southerners, whose greatest fear was a slave revolt. They were also surprised by Northerners' sadness over Brown's execution. They came to believe that Northerners supported the use of force against them and that they would have to protect themselves. There was no single event that led to the sectionalism seen in the antebellum United States. The differences grew into distrust among leaders in the United States government as well as the people across the country. Unfortunately, the groundwork was laid for distrust to evolve into large-scale fear, anger, and hatred. Eventually, negotiation and compromise failed to provide a peaceful solution. The passion of emotion found in sectionalism propelled the country into its bloodiest war.